Welcome to the Climate Change and National Security mini-series. My name is Deray Jalili from King's College London, and I'm joined by Matt MacDonald from the University of Queensland. Over the course of this series, we'll be talking with key experts about how different government institutions are reacting and responding to the security implications of climate change, especially in the run-up to COP26.
Always think about different elements of our climate policies as things that can interact with each other. So it's not like having a bunch of Lego bricks. If the more policies you have, you can just add them all up and finally have a nice tall tower and you'll have enough of them to solve the problem.
Welcome to the final episode of the Climate Change and National Security podcast mini-series. Today, we're going to be looking at the challenges and risks that are facing proposed solutions for mitigating and adapting to climate security, from controversial large-scale climate engineering interventions through to wider transitions to low-carbon development. We're thrilled to be joined by Olaf Curry, Professor of Global Security Challenges at University of Leeds and an expert in international politics of climate geoengineering technologies, as well as Nahu Miramachi, reader in environmental politics in the Departments of Geography and KCL and director of the King's Water Hub Research Group. Thank you for joining us today, Olaf and Nahu. It's wonderful to have you both here. Before we jump into some of our questions, I know there might be some listeners who aren't aware of what climate engineering and low carbon transitions are. I'd love to get your sort of elevator pitch on how you might explain this. Olaf, are you happy to lead us off with what is climate engineering?
Yeah, so climate engineering is a sort of collective term for a whole lot of very, very different things, but the common denominator is that they are technical interventions in the global climate system to offset the impacts of global warming. So two kinds, basically. One is designed to reflect more light out into space and so reduce the amount of incoming energy. And we usually call those solar geoengineering. And that can be done, or that is being looked at. I don't know if it can be done. Nobody knows yet. But the methods of doing that range from spraying particles in the stratosphere to changing the reflectivity of surface areas, like through gene manipulating crops or painting roofs white even. And then the other category is basically carbon removal. So it's greenhouse gas emissions in reverse. How do we take gigantic amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it somehow safely? So they're quite different technically, but they have the common feature that they raise the possibility of decoupling rising emissions from global warming, basically, in a very rough sense.
Thank you. And I know it's a subject that is becoming increasingly sort of interest, and as I said, potentially a controversial one. Nahu, are you happy to explain what a low carbon transition is?
Sure. Low carbon transition, I guess the hint is in the name. It's about a transition towards a more low carbon based economy. You might hear the term low carbon transition used interchangeably with things like low carbon development, or green development, or climate compatible development. In some cases, you might hear about green infrastructure. But again, it's a loose term. It's a broad term that covers both climate adaptation and mitigation action that tries to look at various forms of carbon emissions reduction, but also keeping some form of development progress going ahead. So things like dams are sort of iconic as low carbon development projects. So dams are a form of electricity production, green energy, but it can also be things like reforestation programs. It can also be new agricultural programs that try and reduce emissions as well. It can be things like mini solar grids. So it can be small scale things like these grids, but it can also be massive mega projects like dams as well.
This is just a fascinating issue area. And of course, as we know, speaking about geoengineering, it does tend to elicit very strong responses. You know, this idea that we are somehow playing God with nature, that we are artificially manipulating Earth system function in different ways, which creates, even if we think there might be some potential in this, or it might be necessary as a stopgap measure, it creates real challenges in terms of how we think about its role relative to other sets of practices, or indeed how it's communicated to the broader public. Can I ask you, I might start with you, Naho, how would you think about it and how would you recommend we think about it in terms of broader practices of addressing climate change, and how should we think about it in terms of how it's communicated to the broader public?
That's a really interesting point. And I've been doing various interviews with people who are carrying out low carbon development projects, whether as donors or implementers on the ground. And it's very interesting the kinds of people who I have access to. So they're development specialists, as well as climate specialists, as well as farming, agriculture, irrigation specialists, as well as water management specialists. And in many ways, low carbon development is nothing new in the sense that it is development. But what a lot of people are saying when I ask them about what's special about low carbon development is that increasingly it's impossible to think about climate adaptation or rather it's impossible to think about development without any adaptation dimension, or it's impossible to think about development and divorcing it from mitigation action. So I think it's very much wrapped up in this notion of how we do development, the modes of development. But one of the things that's quite clear is that the stakes are high, right? When you carry out these development projects, whether they're large scale dam projects, whether they're small scale renewable energy projects, the trade-offs are immense, because we're talking about people's livelihoods, how we can reduce or not their vulnerability, what kind of changed access to natural resources they might have, how does water access change as a result of developing these infrastructure projects. So I think it brings about a lot of these new sort of considerations, new dimensions of considerations that we have to do to existing development ideals and ideologies around what does progress mean, what does economic development look like in this particular region of the world, in this particular community.
Olaf, I know from following your work in this space, you'll have plenty to say about this question, about how we think about geoengineering sitting alongside the other sets of responses to climate change, or indeed how it should be communicated.
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is that we should always think about different elements of our climate policies as things that can interact with each other. So it's not like having a bunch of Lego bricks. If the more policies you have, you can just add them all up and finally you have a nice tall tower and you'll have enough of them to solve the problem, because they interact with each other in a dynamic way. And we know that from other areas, one policy in one area interacts in unexpected ways with policies in a different area, or indeed in the same area. And especially with something as wicked a problem as climate change, you know, this is a basic starting point, is to say that it's not just a question of do we need both, which is the sort of objection I very often hear, isn't it? You know, why are you worrying? Because we need all of this. Well, maybe we do, but then we need to have some very, very clear strategies for how to avoid the interactions that we don't want. The big one is, of course, thinking about and talking about geoengineering solutions going to take away urgency or focus from other green transition policies.
So this is the moral hazard argument. I mean, how compelling do you find that position?
It's pretty obvious in carbon removal that, I mean, just if you look at the integrated modeling, when you plug in to explain, when we say look at the integrated modeling, we mean models that include society or the economy and the climate. And these are used to look at sort of pathways forwards. How do we stay under 2 degrees? How do we stay under 1.5 degrees? As soon as you introduce carbon removal, which happened, by the way, back in 2005 or so, they began producing models which had these, it immediately displaced a whole load of emissions reductions. So you don't need to be morally corrupted for this to be a problem. You just need to devise a policy tool that is programmed to find the cheapest route to staying under a particular target. And then you plug in some technology, which is just a piece of paper, basically, to say, what if we assume we can take out so many gigatons of carbon with bioenergy you know, biofuels, plants that capture the carbon. You burn the biofuel plant material in a power station. The power station has some special equipment fitted to it, so it sucks out the carbon before it gets pumped out into the atmosphere, and then you store it underground in some empty oil fields. Now, these things exist in theory, and now they exist in the models, and they immediately displace huge amounts of emissions reductions. So this is not a theoretical problem. Or if you look at Shell's Drive Carbon Neutral campaign, you can now buy petrol for your car from Shell. And because of carbon capture as a concept, mostly they're using planting, you know, forestry and saying that that's offsetting the emissions from the petrol that they're selling to motorists. I don't think it's a theoretical risk. You know, these things are there in front of you if you want to see them. And now that we've got this net zero framing of our climate policy, we've basically rolled together carbon removal with emissions reductions into one mushy concept of net zero. Scientifically makes sense because we do need to get to net zero, and there's probably going to be a bit of residual emissions that you can't get rid of. Just so you will need to capture some CO2. So it's all set up basically for this, to make a big sliding scale where we can replace reduction of emissions with carbon capture.
It's interesting the way that you're sort of talking about these framing mechanisms, and it reminds me of some of your work as well, Naho, and that idea of unintended consequences and the nature of these things being so interlinked and so forth. You've talked about the moral hazard aspect and, let's say, shifting away from a development lens, perhaps, and how these things can remove funding from other areas. If we were to take a more sort of hard-nosed approach to security, or a more traditional concept of security, other than that delaying or that removal of funding from other potentially more valuable areas for mitigation adaptation, what are some of the potential security implications of these activities? You know, what challenges or conflict-related issues might they cause? I might start with you on that, Naho, because it's interesting the idea that a low carbon transition could engender some form of conflict.
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants to do something about climate change, right? So it, in many ways, a lot of these adaptation and mitigation projects come with good intentions. But one of the things that I've noticed is that it does produce winners and losers. Just as with any development project, there are always those who benefit from new technology or new schemes, new forms of financing for these mitigation or adaptation projects. There are also equally those who miss out. And one of the things that has become increasingly clear is that low carbon development, however you pitch it, might still have the scope to further marginalize those who don't have access to decision making, to further alienate those who should be included in decision making but are not. And quite often these are already vulnerable members of society, whether they be women or children or disabled people or minority groups, people who don't have citizenship recognized by the state, for example. So it brings about all of these very tricky, very complex issues about how do people who are already vulnerable seek any form of further benefit from these new initiatives, even though they might be, you know, pitched as goodwill, good intentioned climate projects. And it's very interesting what Olaf was mentioning about how, you know, there's a big policy move, a global policy move towards doing something about climate change. And these decisions of global policies have impacts on the ground at the local level. And one of the dangers of thinking blindly about low carbon development and not giving due consideration to the security aspects of low carbon development is that these so-called global policies, often led by the global north governments and countries, might have these perverse impacts on Global South, where, you know, things like insurance, flood insurance or agricultural insurance are used as a geopolitical means to keep people where they are and sort of label the Global South as a risky place, as a dangerous place that requires all of these interventions, whether it's in the form of insurance or infrastructure or just simple sort of capacity building for adaptation. But there's a dangerous narrative, I think, lurking under the surface about how there are these certain risk hotspots or these dangerous areas within the Global South that need some form of intervention so that this global policy is not disturbed, so that the geopolitical order is not disturbed. And I think if you look at these singular projects of climate adaptation or mitigation, quite often it's very difficult to see these kind of dangerous undertones. But when you see how various programs, various initiatives are taken up, whether it's geoengineering or whether it's these adaptation programs, etc., it's hard not to notice the nuanced difference between the sort of narratives portrayed by the global north and the narratives that are unspoken in the global south. And I think this is where a lot of the times climate security has come from a place of national interests and military trying to sort of defend against threats to the environment, threats from the environment. But clearly that produces a certain kind of geopolitical order that produces a certain way of viewing the world, which might not, as I'm arguing, benefit the most vulnerable, especially in global south areas.
In a way, do you see this as being part and parcel of a wider securitization of some of these issues, or is it almost a separate entity?
I think you know, this securitization of the environment is not new in the sense that there's been debates about environmental security since the end of the Cold War. So climate change is, again, not new in this regard. But I think, as I say, the stakes are higher. The sort of the ways in which different parts of the government is mobilized, whether it's the military, the intelligence, the diplomacy arms of the government are mobilized, are quite striking, I would say. It's definitely commanding people's attention. You know, climate change is not in the realm of water managers anymore. It's not in the realm of forestry managers anymore. Why do you see people who are in foreign diplomacy talking about it? It's because there are these security implications. So that's the kind of interesting, unique aspects that I'm seeing right now.
Olaf, do you have those same fears when it comes to securitization, militarization of sort of geoengineering?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels here to what Naha's talking about, in the sense, I mean, it used to be easy to think about climate change as an environmental problem in a neat kind of way. But clearly, I mean, you can see it also at COP26 in Glasgow, that this is about development space. It's about power in the international system. It's about vulnerable populations, land rights, the fear of land grabbing, you know, from very resource and land intensive climate solutions. So all these things really mixed up. And on top of that, you have the sort of traditional notion of security as national security, stuff that Matt has worked on as well, which in the context of an overall sort of climate emergency framing, all of these things sort of get an extra boost, so to speak. The dynamics become more charged. And I think for good reason, but there's also a lot of different things hiding under this climate security label that really need to be disentangled.
That's a really interesting sort of jumping off point to think, you know, when there has been this focus on geoengineering, a lot of the challenges thrown up, because there have been obviously all these debates that around the security implications of climate change, but in some ways geoengineering raises questions about the potential security implications of responses to climate change, especially when it comes to some of the challenges of what governance would look like and the potential that you would have unilateral deployment of things that could have ecological consequences in other parts of the world. How challenging are some of those governance arrangements, and what are the potential for that to create more traditional sort of forms of instability, even tension, even conflict? I might start with you this time, Olaf.
The idea of solar geoengineering, the idea of cooling the planet with aerosols, for example, or space mirrors or whatever it is, it comes out of Earth systems modeling research mainly. And the, one of the features of that kind of research is that it looks at the world as one coherent, interconnected system, which of course the climate system is, the Earth system is. But as an IR person, an international relations security scholar, you work on a different sort of basis, which is that the world is fragmented. It's divided into multiple different uneven societies. And this has multiple implications, including security dynamics. And I think the possibly the security challenges, the security political dilemmas involved in a single point sort of global intervention in the climate is maybe a bigger challenge overall than the technical challenge of actually injecting aerosols 25 kilometers up in the air or whatever it is, which is ultimately probably solvable in many ways. I think it's crucial and it should be set, you know, front and center and not a sort of afterthought as, you know, oh, here's this possibility, but by the way, we would need some governance. You know, I think it should be thought much more organically together as if this ever becomes feasible technically, where are we going to be in terms of international politics?
That does seem to speak to the concern of some that the question that this will be taken on by technocrats and the question is one of can we do this rather than actually should we do it. Naha, did you want to come in on this question about governance?
Yeah, no, this is really interesting because I think a lot of these low transition, low carbon development projects really expose challenges of governance. It's not a challenge per se of how do you install a mini solar grid or how do you install a dam or how do you set up your new agricultural program. It very much is about the capacity for various local governments to carry out these projects. It's about the ways in which donor organizations can understand how power relationships are affected as a result of these new projects being rolled out. It's about how accountability is sought in the ways in which these projects distribute benefits and the kind of burdens that are produced. I was speaking to somebody this morning who was talking about the fact that you could really roll out perfect plans of climate-induced disaster prevention. But if you don't have the capacity on the ground to implement it, then you're going to be in big trouble, you know, despite your good intentions of adaptation, despite your good intentions for preventing these climate change impacts. If you don't have these structures of good decision making, how you look after your finances, how you do awareness raising, how you include people and do forms of consent, how you ensure that you have consent. If these are not in place, then you almost are set up to fail. And in many ways, these are, you know, time-long issues that development has faced and time-long issues that generally governance has tried to tackle with. But we always seem to fall short. But I do like to be hopeful. I don't want to sound all pessimistic, but you know, I guess the thing is to consider how do we keep our eye on the ball, not just on climate, but also on these multitude of other factors that are so crucial to governance.
It's difficult to talk about these subjects sometimes without a feeling of sort of inevitability and that idea of, you know, a lot of the narratives around geoengineering, for example, is this idea that it will be used by militaries to impact on the security of other states, you know, and Naho, you've also looked at that idea of the narrative surrounding resource conflicts and so forth, that we fall into this principle of water wars that actually may not necessarily be as inevitable as we think, and that there are almost opportunities here as well as risks. You know, there are opportunities for diplomacy, there are opportunities for coordination and so forth. I mean, based on that sense sometimes of inevitability, but that sense of potential opportunities developing from these solutions, I'd love to know your predictions on the ways in which these phenomena might evolve over the next decade or so. What's your kind of sense as to where we're going with geoengineering, with low carbon transitions. Olaf, I'll throw over to you.
It's crystal ball time, Olaf.
Well, I think what you started by noting that these ideas are definitely shooting up the political agenda. I think they're shooting much quicker up the political agenda than the technical feasibility research is expanding. I mean, it's still a very, very small field of researchers looking at this at a very early stage. So I think the direction of travel is hype, no doubt about that. The question is how to manage that and how to do some responsible research in this area. I mean, one suggestion that I heard that I liked was that we should look into it, assuming it's never going to be feasible, basically. So try to not be lulled into any false sense of security in terms of, you know, geoengineering is coming down the line. I think you're angling more to the question is, like, is it going to be a potential peacemaker as well? Is it also a potential for increased cooperation and coordination? Maybe it is. I mean, the only thing I would add to that argument is to say that just because you have international agreements and cooperation doesn't mean there isn't power and geopolitics involved. And there's a great book called How to Do Things with International Law by Ian Hurd, which basically makes the argument and points out that all international agreements have been made, and many of them are made actually at the end of a war where one of the parties is sort of right down on the floor. So the main instruments and architecture of the international system were made in a moment like that. So it's not that just because you have an agreement, it's all democratic and everybody's happy. I mean, international law is a zone of political combat and geopolitical struggle. And so any agreements that we might be able to come to, which I hope if this ever becomes relevant, this geoengineering stuff, especially the solar stuff, you know, that's going to be similarly made in the context of gross global inequality in terms of wealth and power. And I think we need to be honest about that and own up to that and say these technologies, these solutions, these climate solutions, these nature-based solutions, they're going to be part of that world as well. We're going to have to try to minimize the damage from that, but let's not be naive.
Naho, do you sort of have a similar prediction? You know, is there a difference between the hype and the technological development? And is there an understanding that difficult decisions are going to need to be made in the next decade or so?
I definitely think, you know, we live in an already difficult time with the pandemic and a debt crisis and increasing inequalities around the world. But in many ways, climate adaptation and mitigation is here to stay. I don't think any government is going to openly go against major movements towards climate change. There has been a lot of political momentum towards it. Sure, there's been lots of disagreements about how to do it and governments that have dragged their feet in coming out with commitments. But in many ways, on the ground, climate change adaptation and mitigation is already being rolled out. And climate change is a part of people's consideration when they do various projects, programs. For farmers, it's a real thing, you know, climate change. For people who are internally displaced due to disasters, it's a genuinely real thing. And I think the emergence of policy debates and some academic studies around environmental peace building, I think, is pointing towards how can we ensure that there is some sort of opportunity in this space of doing something about climate change. And while it's still very nascent, I think there is some level of thinking around how can we ensure there are pathways to peace building that are part of these adaptation projects or processes. And one of the things that I've been really interested in is thinking about conflict sensitivity and how different donors, implementing agencies are thinking about conflict sensitivity of their renewable energy projects or climate related projects. And they've got to sort of really think from the start, what kind of winners and losers will it end up creating? What kind of inequalities will it end up exacerbating? And how can you do to minimize these impacts and also maximize on these opportunities? So I think there is nascent thinking around these opportunities, if you speak to people who try and practice conflict sensitivity, they will say it's really difficult. It's not easy. It's not mainstream yet. So I think there's an element of truth in there as well. But as I say, it's very much about how do we utilize existing policy tools and policy narratives already right now. So Olaf talked about international agreements, and we have plenty of these international environmental agreements now. But the question might be, how can we make it more flexible in the face of climate uncertainty? A lot of existing, for example, water sharing agreements might not hold in the future. So how can we ensure some sort of flexibility in place? What can we do with our existing policy tools? Do we combine more policy tools to ensure that we can adapt to the ever-changing context? How do we better pick up these power relations that are changing? How do we pick up on these inadvertent impacts as projects are implementing? And I think, you know, we might not see these radical changes in the way we do, but maybe it's about these policy tweaks that come along the way that we might see more evidence of.
It's fascinating to hear both those responses from Naho and Olaf. Reminded me of, so I'm writing something with Simon Dolby, who insisted you have to read this novel, The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson, which talks about this future climate change scenario and possible responses to it. But both the ministry that emerges as this kind of supranational style sort of organization, but separate from the UN, but then also the premise begins with this horrendous heat wave, and then the state involved essentially unilaterally deploying geoengineering through SAI. This becomes then the lightning rod for, God, we have to have some type of agreement about what this all looks like. So it's interesting that increasingly some of those ideas that seem like they might be as much fictional or things that we hadn't even been on the radar at all in the past, we need to genuinely start thinking about, especially when it comes to something that we know as little about as geoengineering interventions and their likely ecological and indeed social implications. Was there anything more that you two wanted to leave the listeners with? Anything that you feel like we didn't quite get to this particular issue on geoengineering, on the security implications of it, that you wanted to share with us?
I think we've covered a lot of topics, and we've covered, you know, different scales of issues in the kind of various global to national to community level policy processes that we go through. But perhaps the one thing that I would sort of leave with is, you know, these projects, these geoengineering projects are very flashy. Dams are really iconic projects, but there's always a real human face to all of this. And I think that's what I want to leave the listeners thinking about. So who is going to benefit from these geoengineering projects or low carbon development projects? We've really got to think about it in people terms. And I think not just in terms of these abstract global changes or global transitions idea. There really is a face to the farmer. There really is to a face to the fisherman who relies on the flood pulse, for example. There really is a huge number of individuals and communities who really do face the brunt of these massive uncertainties and impacts. So even though we may have talked about these sort of grand schemes, as it were, these grand schemes definitely come down to the individual. And I hope you might have a chance to reflect on that and maybe ask colleagues what their experiences have been when they've been out into the field or other projects where they've come across these really micro stories of how people have been affected.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Naho. And along with Matt's Kim Stanley Robinson story about India grabbing the reins of a global sunscreen, that's not mixing the metaphors too badly. The point that I'd perhaps like to make is that the idea of climate security obviously is amorphous. It changes shape. And for one minute, it's about national security, how climate's going to create some kind of international chaos that requires military interventions and borders. And the next minute, climate security is about securing the global ecosphere from collapse. The object suddenly becomes the ecosphere, or maybe it's about livelihoods and preserving a way of life, whether that's the indigenous farmer in the global south, or the American way of life, which was famously not up for negotiation at Kyoto, and which one of these notions of security that gets invoked, and whether that's in low carbon transitions or in massive amounts of carbon removal or in solar geoengineering, it's really good to be aware of who is being secured against what. And actually, the Kim Stanley Robinson thing, I think the other maybe point that I'd like to make is that in that example, there's a tendency to think environmental change is the determinant of societal reactions. And the assumption has been very often, I think, that when climate change impacts get sufficiently bad, then we'll do something about it finally. I'm beginning to wonder about that. And, you know, it's never that simple. It's never that deterministic that the change in the environment creates necessarily a certain political societal reaction. It could go the other way, that rather than finally acting, you know, climate changes contribute to a kind of global crisis that engenders less conducive, less climate action, more regressive, just to end on a really depressing note.
I was thinking, you know, my own country, obviously Australia, we're having similar policy debates that we were 20 years ago, just about 12 months after half the eastern seaboard was on fire. So in the Australian context, this nice, easy relationship between the arrival of climate disaster and the sea change in climate policy is not necessarily that evident.
No.
I'll leave it on those points. I don't think there's any way I could create a summary or two points to sort of conclude this series on that are more relevant and more well expressed than the two that you've just put forward. So thank you so much, Naho and Olaf. Really fantastic way to round off this podcast series and some really interesting perspectives. I'm sure we'll be seeing a lot more of debate on these issues as we go forwards. So thank you for explaining it to our listeners, and a really fascinating podcast.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. In addition to this series, the University of Queensland and King's College London are working together to create open access educational tools on climate security challenges and opportunities. We'd like to thank the King's COP26 engagement grant for funding these activities, and the University of Queensland for providing us with new insights from its Climate Change and National Security International Responses project. If you're interested in learning more, please visit the Environmental Security Research Group webpage at King's College London.